Welcome to the Sliding Windows. My guest today is the person responsible for the package manager for Windows, which Microsoft presented for the first time at the Build conference in 2020. This long overdue technology has its beginnings in Canada, where an independent software developer laid the foundation that inspired Microsoft to create its implementation. You will remember I had this software developer, Kayvon Beji, as a guest in episode 18. I'm very much looking forward to my guest today and thus to the continuation of this exciting story. I'd like him to introduce himself first. Have an enjoyable time.
I'm Demetrius Nealon, and after high school, I joined the U.S. Navy. I spent 4 years in the service and spent time in Florida, California, and Washington State, where I met my wife. After the Navy, I went back to Texas. I did some construction work for a while, just getting a change of pace, was kind of tired of being an electrician. I'd always loved computers growing up, so my first job after that was working at a very small dial-up internet provider, and I spent a little bit more than a year there, and then I went to another startup company doing wireless technologies. I got into the paging industry. In North America, there was a big consolidation, and I started out at Mobilecom. We were acquired by Arch Wireless, and then the company later acquired PageNet. Lots of things have happened since then. I did work both as a consultant and a full-time employee for different technology companies. I worked at Verizon when they were rolling out the fiber optic network. I did a small fintech startup company that I did some consulting for as an enterprise architect. I did a startup company where I actually got a patent for GPS pet tracking devices. And then after that, got into some other consulting work, ended up doing some database work for a finance company, and then into what I would say is kind of the larger tech companies at that point. I moved to Washington State, and I did some contract work at Microsoft working on Azure and the billing systems. After the 18 months were up, I went to VMware. I did a lot of automation work at VMware, going from...
What was the name of that company again?
VMware, yeah. Well, I'm trying to think of the progression through the career.
It's a little bit funny.
After VMware, I worked at Amazon, and then after Amazon was Microsoft.
Just across the street, more or less. Yeah, it's a very interesting career. What did you do at the Navy, if I may ask?
I was an electrician.
An electrician. So, interesting. It's a special kind of technology, right? You go to sea, but
you're
military. So
you're out at sea, and it's a three-phase, ungrounded, 60-hertz electrical system.
Mm-hmm. But you didn't. You were not on a submarine. You were on a proper ship.
Surface ship. I was on a nuclear-guided missile cruiser.
Oh.
Our job was to essentially be able to imitate the lighting and the magnetic signature of an aircraft carrier so that if there was inbound enemy rockets or missiles, they would target us and not the aircraft carrier.
Interesting. You mentioned literally the word dial-up provider. So that sounds like me, like the 1990s when the internet became popular in my career, right? At the same time.
Yeah. It was 1996, and we had about 100,000 customers, sort of that range of customers in the Dallas-Fort Worth market in Texas.
Today, our main topic is the app installer. But what is the real name of the team that you lead? Is there an interesting name or just a number? Or?
So the current name of the engineering team is InstaDev.
Yeah.
The team that I'm on is WD4D, which is Windows Designed for Developers.
Oh, interesting.
And that rolls up into a larger organization, E4D, which is Engineered for Developers.
Oh, interesting. Of course, we want to talk about Winget today, but if we want to create a certain timeline and look at it from a historical perspective, it all began with a guy with an independent software vendor. I had it on that show. Kayvon Beji, he had a great idea. He was a little bit annoyed. He told me of chocolate tea because he saw certain issues and said, maybe I have another alternate approach. And he created AppGet. It was very interesting. I really liked that interview with him. I encourage you to listen to that. he open sourced it, and someone at Microsoft that was before you started in that team saw that and thought that that is very useful, very meaningful, what we did. And you took that as a template. If you look at the GitHub repository, you own him credit. His name is mentioned that he was, he created the philosophy behind that. But what a little bit, some of the things that are seem to me a little bit strange is if we just talk about the word WinGet, it's getting complicated because the product itself, the software, is called App Installer. That is the side-loading application, and you get it in the Windows Store. And later on, someone added the App Installer CLI. App Installer CLI XE, and someone said, oh, that is not the best name we could think of, and you renamed it to WinGet. That is the story in short. But let us start at point zero from what you know, because you have not been there from the very, very first day. You became a Microsoft employee, and you took that team a little bit later on. The very, very first approach was a little bit different from what I know, what you already told me. WinGet was made for something else. What was it? What was the primary target in the beginning days?
The primary target was building a package manager for developers. That was the basic idea. And we had quite a few different design decisions that had been made before I joined the team. I joined in December of 2019, and Build 2020 was the initial preview launch. So in that short few months, I had to quickly get up to speed with what had been built, try to figure out the most important features to get out, and make sure they landed. We went through the legal and branding and marketing teams discussions, and the original product name that was selected was Windows Package Manager. But I'll definitely give a shout out to Scott Hanselman, who was the one that was really influential in recommending and suggesting that we use WinGet.
Ah, I didn't know that. Interesting.
And you always executed it by calling WinGet on the command line, but it's actually an app execution alias that would pick that up. If you knew about App Installer CLI.exe, you were already sort of going into system files and trying to figure out what binary is actually getting executed. And the App Installer was already something distributed for sideloading of MSIX apps. And the decision was made to bring WinGet into that since it was already something that was essentially part of the operating system. It's delivered by the Microsoft Store, but it was already present. So it seemed to make sense to pull all of that functionality around managing software into that one package that supports MSIX.
The architecture of the store apps, the MSIX pictures, are a little bit hard to understand sometimes because you have multiple folders where the software resides. You can install, that is the primary idea. You can install anything as a regular user. You don't need admin rights, but this leads to problems because what happens if the application leads admin rights? We will chat about that later. And so the first user that downloads it creates a kind of cache. I would describe it like that. And then you create some aliases, some shortcuts. You mentioned it, and the user can call it. When you published it at Build, it seems to be a tool for Windows 10. Later Windows 11, for the client, not for the server. Mm-hmm. But in the beginning, that was different, right? Because when I look at the source code, it is C++. And all of a sudden, you think, why is it C++? Can you tell a little bit about the idea having WinGet as a command line tool for the server?
I don't know that server was an original target, but I do know that there were early discussions about what language to build the tool in and how we were going to build it. There were some early discussions with the PowerShell team that predated me. My understanding was that because of NanoServer at the time, mm-hmm. that did not ship with a version of PowerShell, in order to have the broadest support, we should go ahead and go with C++. But I believe later the evolution of different business requirements and targets had shifted. So we ended up only deploying on Windows Desktop.
Yeah. And that is a little bit that gives me some headache. And many people in the IT space really suffer from that approach because they think it is so obvious that we need something like WinGet all over the places, especially on the normal installation of server. I focus on what previously was called Server Core. But today, if you just click through the setup wizard, you will end up with a server without a proper GUI. And it's so obvious that we need something like Winget to keep that thing up and running. And it would be even better if you could also get drivers, get Windows updates. So that is something that is very desirable from my point of view. And I think many, many colleagues apply to this idea. I think you hear that often, do you?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So you build it up. And I think, first of all, we have to talk a little bit about how Winget works. What I said that Kay von Beijie complained a little bit about Chocolaty. And I don't want to offend Chocolaty, but his main criticism was that the second that you see a new software and you think, oh, it's great, I need an installer, you create a script for Chocolaty and you're the owner of that part of Chocolaty. And that leads to a situation where some software products do not get that proper care that someone wants. And so his idea was to get rid of any arbitrary code. And Winget does exactly that. You have a kind, I call it a receipt, a cooking receipt. You call it a manifest, where it is simply markup language where you describe the installation process. Can you tell a little bit about, maybe a little bit more in detail, how does that work? What is the approach? How from an interview, how does that work that Winget gets Adobe Reader, for example, on the machine?
So, as you said, we don't do any scripting. There's no pre-deploy or post-deploy actions available. We wanted to go with a purely declarative syntax so that you could give us the metadata, and then we reason about what logic is the appropriate default behavior, and then we'll provide arguments and switches for users to change those behaviors and potentially settings to make it essentially sort of a permanent state that they want their system in. The declarative syntax allows us to break things into classes of problems, and it means that the client doesn't really have to interpret or parse anything. And that was really one of the security design tenets. And if I look at how we started out, it was very similar to the manifests that apt-get had. And I didn't even know about the apt-get product when I had joined this team. So there was a little bit of a learning curve there and a little bit of a surprise for me. But the idea was very sound from the perspective that Microsoft would take on security. So we evolved it. We ended up deciding to split into multiple files so that you have one that primarily describes the installer and you're looking at different things like the architecture of the hardware that it's targeting, possibly the scope, whether or not it's installed for the user or the whole machine, possibly locale and other dimensions that would uniquely identify an installer. We then split the rest of the metadata for what I would say is just describing the software to the user into files that were based on a locale. That way it's very easy for somebody to come in and do a localized version to support their language. And there's not any risk that they're going to go back in and accidentally change the behavior of the installer if they're just trying to add a description for their native language. The last file is essentially just a pointer to help glue them all together. And we use one manifest per version of a package.
These manifests are public?
Yes.
It's a GitHub repo. So you have two repositories, one for the application and another only for the manifests.
Another two.
Okay. Where are they for?
You have the reference implementation of the REST source.
Mm-hmm. Ah, yeah.
And you have the Winget create tool that was written in C# to help for CI/CD scenarios.
Oh, yeah, we will talk about that in a few minutes. Yeah, I forgot that. It's correct. It is public. Anyone could change it. Anyone could fork it if he or she wants it like that. And if you look at it, it simply describes stuff like the URL where it's downloaded. So in most cases, you do not own the files. You
correct.
Just point to ftp.vendor.something or you point to the store. We will talk about that. But you mentioned scopes. scopes drive me a little bit nuts, if I'm be honest. The first thing that drove me nuts is your defaults are in most cases user scope.
Yes.
So if an application provides a user and a machine scope, that means a user can install that in its profile without admin rights, or an admin installs it for anyone, then the default is user. That drives me nuts. Why did you do that?
So there's actually additional exceptions to that. There are cases where a user needs administrative rights to install something for user mode, mm-hmm. typically when there's an NT service required.
Okay.
The reason we defaulted to user, again, was the security posture of trying to get it such that the default experience is not going to require elevation. Now, we're still very limited in what we can do there based on what the installer offers and supports. And even those two scopes are slightly different with MSIX, since it actually lays down the files in one place. Each user gets their own copy that gets registered when they log in, so that there's typically only one copy of the binaries on the system, but everybody gets their own virtual copy, and it runs isolated in a container.
Yeah. You can change that. And in previous days, I first of all tried --- scope machine. But the problem back then was if the manifest only has one description, then it fails. So if it only has a user part and there is nothing like a scope machine, then you get an error message. And in recent versions, you change that. If there is no scope machine, it simply goes through. So that leads to another problem from my point of view. I can force Winget to use the machine installer, but I never know if it exists, so I will find out by looking in the manifest. So you change that. But there is another, a better way to change that behavior, changing the Winget settings.
Correct.
Can you describe how that is done?
Sure. So we have a settings file that's written in YAML, and we do have a JSON schema. So if you're using an editor like VS Code and you've got the Red Hat YAML plugin, you'll get IntelliSense and tooltips and help. And we typically offer settings for anything that is sort of a, you know, toggle value or an enumeration. We also have a notion of preferences and requirements. Mm-hmm. So if you were to say, for example, with scope, you prefer machine, Winget would default to the machine install. If that's not available, then it would drop down to user. But if you were to say require and Winget couldn't honor your request, then Winget would raise an exception.
The Winget settings from a user's perspective is a little bit, I don't want to name it odd, but unfamiliar, because it simply opens a text editor. That is the new Microsoft, where you don't put things into the registry. What we did before, you usually create JSON files, and if you don't have a GUI, then you get you'll be shown the poor native text file, and that is the case here. It is not unfamiliar. It is unfamiliar. It is not odd. You can change that. But for someone who's a little bit afraid of the command line, it's a hurdle. It's a right. It's absolutely not so easy to get that. We can install these sources, and very often customers do ask, who checks these manifests, who checks these files? And to be honest, when you point to, let's say, the FTP server of Adobe, you don't care, because it is up to Adobe to get that stuff up and running. How secure can that be from your perspective? You rely, of course, on the vendor, but how do you make sure that nobody puts something into the manifest that might be malicious?
So there are quite a few variables to think about. We do a series of static analysis checks as well as dynamic analysis checks during validation. So any URLs are going to go through Smart Screen, looking to make sure that the reputation check passes. Any of the domains for any of the URLs are also going to be compared with the policy that we have. So we don't want you to, for example, say that the product comes from adobe.com when in fact it's coming from other nefarious URLs. So we have policy checks for that. We will then go into static analysis for malware or potentially unwanted applications. We have an internal service that we use that partners with several other antivirus vendors. They will look at the binary. They will look at the hash that's been provided in the manifest. They will look for any detections. And if there are any from any AV vendor, that is an automatic fail. We're going to stop at that point. If it's a false positive, there's a process to go submit the application through a Microsoft website. Assuming all of that is good, then we get into dynamic validation, where we actually will run the installer in a hardened, isolated environment where it will get downloaded. We'll check it against the hash that was provided in the manifest. We have a file watcher and some other metadata watching behavior where we look to see what files were written, where did it appear the application got installed, looking for those typical registry entries. Then we will launch the application in the hopes that it's not necessarily immediately going to pull down malware with Defender actively running. Assuming all of those things are successful, then it goes back to the community where one of our moderators would go and do a review on that. And what we're looking at in that review primarily is just how complete is the manifest. If somebody were to run search or show or any of the commands that are going to provide metadata, are they going to see enough information to be able to reason about what the application is and what it's doing, and as much of the other metadata to help WinGet to have the appropriate behavior for those scopes and those architectures. Then, if a moderator approves it, it will get merged, and later it will get published in the default WinGet catalog, which is a separate MSIX package that contains a SQLite database.
If I think about a vendor creating nightly new builds and changing the FTP source again and again and again, does that make a difference once the package is created and I just want to check in a new version? Is that a difference from this point of view?
There's a couple of different things that will happen. Some publishers will offer unique URLs for every version of their software. That works best for WinGet because those hashes...
Always the current. Yeah.
The hash is always the current one for the current version. Many vendors actually use what I call generically a vanity URL, which means the installer is always at the same URL, but the publisher can change the binary at that location. And in that case, WinGet would download, compare it to the hash, and WinGet would stop right there and say, hey, the application that you downloaded does not match the hash we have.
Which happens very often from my experience with Google Chrome. Yeah. But the whole process of checking it, is that a difference if just there is a new minor change? Or is it the same procedure over
and over? The same validation happens on every single manifest.
Yeah. That's pretty interesting. I would assume that the vendors themselves create these manifests.
It would be lovely if they did, but many of them have not become aware of WinGet, or their customers haven't requested that they do that. I would say the ideal scenario is that a vendor would experiment with WinGet to understand how it works with their software in upgrade flows, uninstall flows, looking at the default switches for the installers, just so they understand what the options are, and then they're able to provide the best experience for their customers.
It's a chicken-egg problem.
It is.
Some vendor might say only few people use that. On the other hand, only few people use it because so many companies do not support it. Can I find out who created that manifest? Is it obvious that Adobe does it themselves or anyone?
It's not obvious at all. The only evidence that you're going to have is the GitHub alias that made the pull request.
But that can be...
And it could be anybody.
Yeah. Would it be an idea to have a tag for that? Something like that? That I can see, I filter the manifest and see those manifests are provided or checked with the vendor itself? That would be an idea, right?
We've discussed the concept of a verified developer. And the idea is Microsoft would formally identify that ISV or that publisher. There would be a relationship established between the two. Then the publisher would be able to say, they officially own this manifest and we could ensure they're the only ones authorized to make a pull request or approve one if we do a slightly different process where they might allow a community pull request. Really, the challenge there is the business process and the cost. Today in the existing Microsoft Store, if you're providing software, you need to pay a small fee that will get your account set up in Partner Center, where you can then publish your application.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, right? So if we compare that to the well-known Linux repositories, the big difference is in many cases, in most cases, the Linux repositories belong to the distribution. So if I have something like CentOS, if I have something like Ubuntu, Debian Linux, they care for a repository where everything is, the installer mechanism, but also the binary files. But you spread it to what I think is clever. You spread it. The binaries are wherever they are, and you simply describe the process. That is, I think, a very nice approach because, as you mentioned before, you don't need to run code, but you rely on simple things. You rely that the application, for example, can be silently installed without any problem. And the fun thing is, the easier it gets, the more it can provide some headache. My keyword is sysinternals. You had a lot of trouble to get that running because that is not an installer, it's just a zip file. Can you tell that story?
Sure. Sysinternals is a very popular piece of software.
Very popular.
And it had never been published in the Microsoft Store because it was essentially a collection of portable applications inside of a compressed zip file. Winget didn't actually natively ship with support for zip or for portable applications, and the sysinternals team decided to go ahead and build an installer so that they could use the Microsoft Store to distribute sysinternals.
But again, if you download it now from the store, because you get it via the Microsoft Store, and you have five different user accounts, then you have to download it five times, or at least you have to push that trigger. So that might be a criticism, right? But that is the store architecture itself. Let's talk about creating these manifest files. You mentioned before you provide a tool. How does that work and how complicated is it to use that tool? If I, for example, a small independent software vendor or an IT professional and I'd like to have tool X, Y, Z, how hard is it to create such a manifest?
I think in the beginning it was a little trickier. There was no tooling support for it. We were really aiming at CI and CD scenarios with Winget Create. And we were able, since we were building another application, we could actually, in some cases, open up the installer to try to inspect it and figure out as much of the critical metadata as we could. We could automatically calculate the hash for the user, ask them a couple of questions, and generate the manifest. Optionally, if you provide your GitHub credentials, it will even generate a pull request for you to submit that package. The learning curve probably isn't that high once you've done it once or twice, or if you go take a look at a few packages that are out there or dig through the documentation. But not very many publishers on Windows have been publishing to package managers extensively, so it is another learning curve for those organizations.
Did we mention the name of the tool, Winget
Create?
Create, yeah, I think we mentioned it. It's quite easy to use, but then again, you said it before, it might not deliver the highest possible. It is surely not polished, so you have to open up the YAML files and do a little bit more work on it, maybe to get it perfect.
Maybe, and there might be a different process for the first manifest that you build. Mm-hmm. But once you've built one and you have one version in the repository, using the update command is a little bit easier because it will carry the majority of that metadata forward. But you can still go in and edit it using the tool. We also have YAML create, which is a PowerShell script that is in the Winget packages repository that the community maintains. That one is also very popular and has a similar help you generate the manifest by asking you some questions.
very interesting stuff. I always download simply a Git clone to this repository and explain a little bit in more detail how that works to customers. But if I just want to see the basic items, is there something like winget show manifest? Does that exist?
There's a show command, but it only gives you a small subset of the metadata. And the installer that it shows is the one that winget expects is the best one or the one that's appropriate for your settings. And it'll show the hash for that and the URL. And in Windows Terminal, you can also just open that URL directly. Yeah.
And what is the preferred one, the one that's first mentioned, the top one?
It will default to the one for your specific architecture, mm-hmm. the one for your locale.
You could have an ARM architecture also. That's
correct.
The reason, right?
Yeah. Correct. And the user scope by default. Mm-hmm. So it just depends how many different installer nodes are in the manifest with different variability. And winget makes some assumptions about what the default is when there are many options available.
There could be the case that you have multiple options because simply the software provides a lot of sub-tools. Just imagine you would install something like Office. Maybe there would be an installer that only gets the basic tools and another one that gets even more. In terms of Office, it's not true, but this is a good example of why there could be so many possibilities. Usually it is just the architecture and user and machine scope, and then it's get uninstalled. So the typical user experience is that you can call winget as a standard user. You do not have to elevate the command prompt. And if needed, then you see the UAC. And the installer itself will prompt you just as it does with any other software if it really needs admin rights, right?
Correct.
That is true for the winget repositories. One final question is, I have to quote Kayvon one more time, but he's really a smart guy. I enjoy talking with him. He had a lot of good ideas, and you took that over and used that today. And one more little thing, he had the idea to create something like a web finger. He named it something like a robots.txt, where a vendor can create a little stub, a hint, maybe a checksum, a URL, so that automatically you can check if this is valid. So you could, for example, think of if you have a certain software, you could create that manifest in a very simple case, simply on your own side, and then it checks. I know that you already thought about these things, so doing double checks, is there anything working in the backgrounds that we will see in the future? Or is that still a problem because the vendors are not so enthusiastic right now?
Well, I think there's some concerns, at least in my mind, from a vendor hosting the manifest mm-hmm. and the installer. That means that if something gets tampered with, you don't have any independent verification.
Exactly.
So we really went all in on the independent verification. Even if you look at the manifest file, we take the multi-file format. We actually do merge it into a single file. We do a checksum on it. We put that file up on Azure. So when we download the manifest, technically we are downloading a single file from Azure Storage, but we already have the hash that we expect in that SQLite database before we pull that manifest down. So we spent quite a bit of time looking at as many of the known vulnerabilities and security concerns as we could to make sure that we weren't installing potentially unwanted applications. Now, in the world we live in today, it's not a matter of if, but a matter of when. Exactly. We have had a couple of examples of software that was put into the system, and we were notified by somebody after the fact that there was something inappropriate or unwanted. And in those cases, we've removed them. Most of them have actually been false positives.
Yeah. And let's be honest, that will appear from time to time. There is not a single vendor that gets 100%, but you have to take care to limit the number of attacks or however you might call that. So if we focus now on the Windows Store, which is another provider for software, it behaves a little bit differently. If you find a package by winget, blank space, search, blank space, and then any kind of name, winget, search, sysinternals, you will find that this is on the store available, but two things are a little bit strange. First of all, the ID, which is very important to install that afterwards, is a not human readable something, and there is no version number, which is ludicrous, and I know that it annoys you. Can you tell us a little bit about the background? The store technology-wise is totally different.
It's completely
different.
What
does that make with GitWinget?
So the way...
Please tell a little bit about the background story.
Sure.
When you approach that team, because that is really interesting.
Sure. The store was going through an evolution where they were looking at supporting what we call Win32 applications or unpackaged, which is just not the traditional store applications. And rather than them having to build all of the support for the other installer types, they were willing to take a dependency on WinGet and leverage WinGet to install those packages. But there was a lot of what we would say legacy software and legacy infrastructure in the store that was not targeted at developers, and the search experience also wasn't designed for developers. So we came together as partners to figure out how to enable WinGet to install the Win32 applications. And then we also did work with them on defining the REST API so that WinGet users via the command line could also install those store applications. But the infrastructure behind the store and the way that metadata is made available, we did not have the version information that we wanted. We also didn't have some of the other pieces of metadata that we wanted, but we knew our customers wanted to be able to install the store applications. So we went ahead and hooked up a search, and it is rudimentary. It's just a substring on the name typically. And you're going to get something, as you said, that just looks like a long random string. It's just sort of a catalog identifier. And if you've ever gone to an application on the website for the Microsoft Store, you'll see that same kind of an identifier. We did talk about building a more human readable name, but that's not something the publishers are used to submitting today. So we would have to come up with some heuristics or an algorithm that would be appropriate for that. And there's been some work that was done on getting version available. And if you run WinGet Show on a store application, you'll see a version number displayed. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't plumbed all the way through to the API that WinGet actually uses mm-hmm. to determine if an upgrade is available or not. But we know the store team is doing work now to provide those in the future. It's just a matter of prioritization and when they're going to be able to get that rolled out.
So there are different. There are simply two different API endpoints that you query, and the one doesn't display what we need to know. Yeah, it's interesting. The store itself is a little bit strange. I never understood why on a professional Windows version, something like an enterprise edition, why Microsoft displays all that crappy software, that games, stuff like that. And that leads to the situation that most companies, at least in my neighborhood, they simply put it off. So that must be a huge problem, because if you want to provide these functionality and useful stuff, just like the Windows Terminal, for example, WinGet itself, sysinternals, serious tools, they all derive from the store, and people completely shut it off. Is there, do people at Microsoft recognize what this strange image of the store creates problems? Do you know what I mean? Do you have an idea that people dislike it because you are always displayed that strange game software and stuff like that? Have you ever talked about that, about the acceptance of the store?
Microsoft is a very large company, and it can take a very long time to evolve a product and ship it in Windows. And I think similar to WinGet, there probably were different priorities or different reasons motivating the creation of the store and the evolution of it over time. So I think we are at a point where it can become obvious that some of the things that were designed and built and plugged into various SKUs of Windows may not be the best fit today. And it's just a question of whether or not it's worth going in and investing and mm-hmm. making those kinds of changes.
Yeah, it's interesting, because the main disadvantage is that you lose the updates, right? So it is not that the end user is not able to click in the store and install something. If you really completely shut it off, then you don't get updates for all the store applications that are already present, just as the Windows Terminal and just as WinGet. And we had that before. I think there is a lot of work to do. I hope that will happen. On the other hand, if I switch to the server now, the store is half bacon in Windows Server. Microsoft always tells me there's no store, but we both know that is not the complete truth, because the store technology is somehow semi-integrated in the Windows Store. You have no visible store, but for example, you have Edge in Windows Server 2022, which is a store app more or less. What is your point of view about integrating the store, maybe in a different manner, in the Windows Server? It's obvious that you're not the man in charge for that, but maybe you have a wish list for that.
I think that package management on server has been a gap, but it's been a gap on Windows mm-hmm. all along. The challenge that I see is that without the store and the automatic updates on server, there is no reasonable way for me to automatically include and distribute WinGet. And as you alluded to, the auto update mechanisms in the store, a lot of that technology is shared with Windows Update. There's an install agent that will do installations. There is MSI exec that is what's used for installing MSI. And then you have the MSIX for doing sideloaded packaged applications. So there's several different technologies. And Microsoft really spends a lot of time and energy in maintaining backward compatibility. And we don't take putting things into Windows Server lightly, especially when you look at the long-term servicing additions, where it can be many, many years that we have to provide support and service for an application. And in some cases, even if customers don't take the latest updates. So we've been looking at several things. Early on, we started building some PowerShell scripts to help bootstrap WinGet mm-hmm. to get the VC runtimes that we need, to get the WinUI XAML that we need for App Installer, and then to actually be able to install WinGet. And as we were looking at some of those things, I had reached out to the PowerShell team. We were looking at going ahead and building DSC resources so that you could potentially use PowerShell DSC as a way to get WinGet on Windows Server. And that led to what we recently announced at Build with WinGet configuration. So there's been a lot of learning and evolution there, but I think the bigger thing in my mind is we're probably never really going to eliminate or get all of the existing useful applications rewritten or repackaged. So WinGet is really trying to meet software developers and publishers where they are today. And what we're starting to see now, after having a few thousand packages in the community repository, is WinGet is really becoming a forcing function, especially with IT professionals and software developers trying to figure out how to manage systems or get into the right state with the right versions of software. They're now seeing what their perception is: WinGet doesn't work, when it might be WinGet has got a bug or might not be working correctly. Could also be that the manifest metadata isn't correct, or it could be that the installer itself doesn't do what I would say are best practices. You know, you can certainly write an installer that will lay some files down and create shortcuts and let you run the application. But WinGet is looking at the registry entries behind Windows apps and features to determine what software is installed, what version is it, and some of the other metadata that we're looking for. So I think WinGet is going to be really good for the Windows ecosystem altogether, and possibly will even have a stronger influence on software engineering globally, yeah, because we're exposing some of those challenges and trying to figure out how to reason about those different challenges in a way that we can do this completely declaratively.
If everything is open source, and you just mentioned that you can create a script and fulfill all the pre-requirements. I showed that very often. It's a little bit annoying because it constantly changes. When the server versions are published, then you have to check that again and again and again. How tempting is it, when everything is open source, just to create one static binary? Does anyone did that?
I believe that one of the moderators has a fork of Winget, and they have essentially a daily build or just a continuous build. I don't remember what the name of it is, but I don't have any problems with that. If the community wants to build the software or they want to go in there and do that, absolutely. It's out there for them to do that.
It's absolutely tempting. It's tempting. Yeah, and there are more tools. I think about something like Winget UI, which on first sight is totally ludicrous because I just got rid of the UI and then someone recreates it. But the problem that the developer tries to solve from my point of view is that you can use Winget as underlying technology, but you have a kind of service that gets all the packages and updates it continuously. What you not do. So with the native Winget application, I have to check all the time. I can create a scheduled task, but the mere mortal does not do such things. And with Winget UI, I'm pretty sure you saw that, you can simply do the automation, simply update anything, and you can integrate stuff like Chocolaty and other things. What do you think about such a tool?
I think they're fantastic tools. People build tools to either learn or to solve a particular problem. I actually did have the opportunity to talk to the author for Winget UI, yeah. And he had a great story for that. I think you should reach out and interview him about it.
Yeah, very good idea. Yeah,
and the other tools are fantastic as well. I think the challenges that we've seen is that some people are just trying to wrap Winget.exe or the command line executable that doesn't give you JSON or other structured data output format, which can be challenging. But we've actually developed a COM API. And we publish NuGet packages that you can consume. That means it's a little bit easier for you to integrate with Winget more directly in your application, and you get more rich objects out of it.
Yeah. And now that we touched that surface, many people are very opinionated and discuss Winget or Chocolaty. I think to you, because we chatted quite a while, before, it is more Winget and Chocolaty. It mustn't be the one or the other. What's your opinion?
And Scoop.
And Scoop. And then maybe something
else. And Impact D. And yeah? You should use the tool that solves your problem. Each domain or each approach that you look at a large complex problem like managing software, you're going to have to make some trade-offs. You either restrict packages because you require a certain bar or certain level of excellence for them, or you deal with the complexity another way, like Chocolaty does the scripting, and there are packages today that Chocolaty installs perfectly that unless the publisher changes how that software installer works, they may never be in the Winget repository for those reasons.
And let's be honest, it is something negative to run arbitrary code, but it's also something very positive because you're not limited to a real installation. You can provide anything with Chocolaty. So that is a unique thing when you have an approach like this. Are there any short-sighted plans to add more sources beside the manifests, beside the store? Is there anything, any low-hanging fruit that you observe?
I don't think so. We designed it so that you could have your own REST source. I think there is a few interesting scenarios that are possible, but there also is a lot of complexity and a lot of risk with having multiple different sources. It also makes the likelihood of search collisions increase as well. And we already see this in some cases where if you have Winget and you have the Microsoft Store both enabled, which is the default way we ship, if you're looking for one of our most popular pieces of software, PowerToys, and you just type Winget install PowerToys, It's going to tell you that there are two matches and you have to disambiguate. Mm-hmm. There's one in the store and there's one in the community repository. Which I think that would be exacerbated with more sources.
Yeah, that is the so-called preview version to differentiate that. Yeah, I think technology like Intune might be an accelerator for your technology. And if I think back to group policy back in the year 2000, We had that approach that you could deliver software MSI packages with group policies. Back in those days, we tried that, but people got a little bit annoyed of that. And then immediately everybody stopped and said that is not the thing that we like. But now that Intune takes over and Microsoft tells us do not use group policy anymore, use Intune, Intune deployment. Am I right that the Intune guys really looking for WinGet because they need such a tool to get more functionality into that?
I don't know if it was more functionality or if it was just, a strategic movement, but there has been a lot of complexity on the work to build a package that will install on Windows when you're looking at those EXE-based or maybe not perfectly built MSI-based applications. And since WinGet had already been solving this problem and partnering with the store, I think it just made logical sense for Intune to go ahead and leverage WinGet.
Definitely.
And
it's lightweight.
And I think over time, there's a possibility that Intune will either start hosting their own private REST sources or they may give IT administrators the ability to target the community repository. But with Intune, there are many more complex security and supply chain management and enterprise types of concerns before they just open that up. So their initial release supports the store applications from the Microsoft Store, and they actually are calling the WinGet APIs on the client to install that software.
I'm pretty sure myself that these guys do care about WinGet because they will need something for that if they want to convince that cloud-based working that we have today, because the traditional deployment solution, they do not work well when people are spread all over the country, sitting in home office all day long. We need something fresh, and I think that, to me, it's a perfect match. I think it's time to come to the real basics. Looking at WinGet, we didn't mention how you really use it because we think everybody is listening to that knows what we're talking about. But the first few examples that you type in, they're really a little bit strange because WinGet feels a lot like a Linux tool. And the fun thing is that when I explain that to customers, they always wonder, why is that double dash? Is that a parameter? People don't get it. For example, you can type in WinGet search power toys, fine. And then you can say, I want to install that. And you type in WinGet install dash dash ID. And we both know that this was invented by GNU because they wanted to get rid of that short parameters in the Unix Linux world, and they wanted to create something more human readable. At least that is what I know or how I describe it. So in many cases, you have something like dash S for abbreviation of source, and dash dash source, the complete word, not abbreviated, to make it more human readable. That is the approach of the GNU syntax, or however you pronounce GNU, GNU, I don't know. We will hear that in a minute. And now you use WinGet, and it feels like a Linux tool. It feels like a mix of dpkg, apt-get install something. It feels like a little bit like Docker. What is the background story for this approach? Do the developers that created that love Linux? What is the background story?
I don't know if it was they loved Linux or they were just following a convention that they had found somewhere. We also will support for the single character abbreviations. Instead of having to type dash A, dash B, dash C,
exactly
you can
I
just
explained.
Do dash ABC.
Yeah.
And, so you have the ability to have the abbreviated.
But you also together, just like in Docker.
Right, yeah. Right. Or you can do the verbose ones. I think the goal is really sort of provide both options and let users have what they want. And it's been quite fun looking at the existing syntax and then trying to figure out what does this look like in PowerShell?
Yeah.
And how do we achieve functional parity in a way where the syntaxes are so different from each other?
We opened the most important door PowerShell. Because the second thing is, okay, you have a Linux-style command that makes a ton of sense if you think about apt-get install. Everybody knows that in the IT space, at least if you have a Raspberry Pi. And you should have at least one. But the second question is PowerShell. Why not PowerShell? You said before, actually, you focus on REST APIs. So from your point of view, if I got that right, the most important thing for you is to provide proper APIs so that anybody can extend that. And the CLI is just one approach. And of course, everybody wants to have rich objects and preferable commandlets. Let's go one step back. You could have rich objects also with WinGet, because you could output some JSON, and this is immediately an object. I guess you heard that before, right? People complained about that. Can you tell a little bit about that?
Absolutely. When we look at the possibility of having separate outputs, it would be a lot of work and a lot of refactoring to be able to do that. And that would work. That work would necessarily take away from work of building native PowerShell objects. So I tend to take an approach where we look across strategic work that we're doing. So that would include the store, Intune, and configuration. I look at what I think of as core capabilities of the package manager, install, upgrade, uninstall, things like that. And then community asks. We prioritize those based on the number of users that have put a thumbs up on the issue. When I'm looking at something like PowerShell, since we started out as a native C++ application, we were basically either going to have completely different implementations or core libraries where anybody could interface it. And that would mean that the CLI would interface it, PowerShell would interface it, and so would somebody communicating directly through COM APIs. So we had a lot of refactoring to do just to get to the point where we could start building functional modules and commandlets. A few years back, I did a hackathon at work, which is where Microsoft lets you spend a week and work on anything you want to. And I decided to do some work to try to figure out if I could use Crescendo to build a module for WinGet. Reached out to Jason and Steve on the PowerShell team, talked with them, talked with some other folks, made an attempt at it, and realized how much impedance there is between PowerShell noun verb syntax and WinGet CLI. Didn't get a whole lot of feedback on it, but most of it was positive. So we made that available in source control, but nobody really could consume it. But that's really sort of the trade-offs that I have to make as a product manager, is trying to figure out what's the next most important thing I can do, what's the most valuable thing. And certainly for the IT pro community, it's predominantly PowerShell. So it's been very exciting to finally have a PowerShell module in the gallery and to be able to get some feedback.
You released something lately, we should name that. To me, how it is not impolite, it's a little bit rough. It's not so mature. And we have to tell that the PowerShell module is not a wrapper of the CLI. You mentioned that before. It is something technologically different if you use the WinGet CLI or the PowerShell commandlet. So it can be that you might use the one or the other for some specific things. So you got rid of the Crescendo thing.
There's still some
deferred approach, or is
there still some Crescendo left? So the commands around adding and removing sources, that's still just calling the CLI its Crescendo, and the source export command actually outputs JSON, although it's not technically well formed. Yeah. It was really optimized to make it easier to build your group policy objects for configuring sources.
Crescendo, we should name that, is a technology heavily based, heavily using regular expressions that tries to recreate the output and try to provide objects instead of text. Think about something like ipconfig, where you might want to have something like a DNS server as a property, and Crescendo at its core functionality tries to do something like that. We also have auto-completion. So you provide such a tool set so that you can also type in something and it delivers the thing that you're looking for. if you're on the right path. So I think I'm totally fine with that. So native commands must not deny the PowerShell. You can integrate it, and if that is done fine, I'm totally fine with that. But of course, let's talk about a little bit about naming. PowerShell, in all its simplicity, can be very complicated. I just had the case that I was just looking for the name of a commandlet, and it gave me more headache than the whole commandlet. And I know that is also true for you. Talk a little bit about your approach to find the correct verbs, the correct nouns for Winget, because now you need more than just a few words.
Yeah, so I'll say, I don't remember who originally quoted it, but they basically say there's two hard things in computer science. Number one is naming things, and number two is expiring a remote cache. We have both of those problems in Winget. So when I started looking at naming things, with Winget, we have a command, winget upgrade all, which tells Winget, go take a look at all installed software. If there is an upgrade available, go ahead and update that software. There's no direct noun-verb pair that seems to really fit that particular behavior.
At least not an approved verb.
Correct.
That's the next step. Yeah.
Correct. So I started looking at the approved verbs. We started looking at the nouns for package, winget package. We thought about manifest. We'll probably do that in a source module. But when an IT professional is thinking about what are these objects they want to operate on, they don't tend to think in terms of a manifest, which is the metadata. They're really thinking about the package. So we landed on winget package for most of these things. And then we went with the defaults for install, upgrade, update. And in the CLI, we added a bunch of aliases. So that was a little bit of my confusion. When I originally looked at the winget commands, we had the source and we had the install, and I didn't want to get update and upgrade overloaded. So we picked one for one command and the other for the other. And now we've got more aliases, and PowerShell's pretty prescriptive about what you would use. So there's still a lot of complexity around naming things. We're getting ready to release pinning here probably in a couple of weeks with the 1.5 release, and there's no pin verb in PowerShell. So we have lock and limit and things like that, or we use the get set type pattern, and when then we have a new noun, it, you know, it would be a winget package pin or something like that.
In this space, it's hard to create what I refer to as posh code, that is my private word, which refers to something like Python code, which means it is a huge difference if you have someone who really knows what he's doing and creates beautiful, readable code, or if you have something. And it's really hard to get that posh code on the road, to get proper verbs, to stick to the rules, because the rules only exist to simplify the life of the user. So that, but that gives you a ton of headaches. And Winget in its CLI approach is pretty good because it meets expectations of those guys who already know apt-get, Docker, what I mentioned before, but these are Linux users. So you rely on the fact that many of us, of course, they know the one and the other and they recognize that scheme. But to recreate that in PowerShell also has the demand to address mere mortal users, to make it as simple, as understandable as possible. And that creates a whole lot of problems. From your perspective, how mature is the PowerShell module today?
I would barely consider it alpha. We are publishing it without the pre-release flags on it. That's because the DSC module has a dependency on it, and we couldn't have a pre-release package depend on another pre-release package. I think currently it's 0.2.1. And if you're familiar with semantic versioning, which I hope you are, if you're not, go to semver.org. You're gonna realize that since we lead with a zero in the primary position, this is unstable software. It will not matter what versions we do after that. according to semantic versioning conventions, I can make breaking changes in every single version that we ship. And I would try not to do that as much as possible. Because when you rename things or you add constraints that are breaking, that's really challenging. And it makes it harder for the consumers of that application from a dependency management standpoint. But what I'm really looking for is for people to tell me, are we getting the right kinds of names on the nouns and verbs and the commandlets? Are we building the right kinds of objects so that the things you expect, piping and chaining things, behaves as you would expect? And what we've learned is, until we shipped it in the gallery, we really weren't going to get a lot of feedback. So it's, you know, even though there's the complexity and the confusion about not marking it pre-release right now, I think we're getting the benefit of more people are using it and we're getting more feedback.
I would summarize that for the busy admin that simply needs the job to be done. There is nothing wrong with using winget.exe inside of PowerShell, using all that auto-completion, all the nice things that you have when you use PowerShell as underlying shell, still using native commands. There is nothing wrong with that, as long as the PowerShell commandlets do not provide the same stability and the same scope of possibilities.
Running the CLI, but you're running it in PowerShell, there is an argument completer, so you can actually get autocomplete with Winget.
Yeah, but on the other hand, that's a trap, because if anyone is satisfied with that, there is no pressure to put more effort into the PowerShell command. So I hope
it's just a convenience for a user.
Yeah, they will. I am pretty sure it will evolve. I guess it's time to open up the last chapter, and this is something you mentioned before: the idea configuration. Configuration as code, code as configuration. The idea that I don't want to run scripts. Instead, I want to describe something. And you mentioned already desired state configuration. So from my point of view, I very often discuss that with people. Desired state configuration has hard times. It was implemented in PowerShell V4, if I got it right. It became mature in PowerShell V5. And I personally would say it died in PowerShell 6, but that's not true. Somehow he's got a second life. Let me say it like that. But the implementation is a little bit different. You have to face a lot of little problems. And the primary question is, or the main question is, how much love does desired state configuration get from Microsoft and from other vendors? Because what is desired state configuration? From my point of view, in very simple words, it is almost the same than what you do with your manifest. It is a way to describe what is the state that you want to be in. How does desired state configuration as technology is connected to your work today? What is the next step?
So we're currently in preview with configuration as code, where you have some winget commands for winget configure that will allow you to pass in the path to a file. We chose YAML again, just being consistent with what we do out on the GitHub repo. But you have sections of code in this YAML file that define the PowerShell module and the resource used to achieve your desired state and the ability for you to pass the properties into that. It's very fledgling, just like when we released Winget as a preview. We're doing this open source. We're looking for feedback. And that's really what helps us to know that we're going in the right direction. But even though I wanted to be able to have something like configuration as code for Windows, I couldn't even begin to do that work before I had a reasonable package manager. And I would say that in my mind, we were close enough once pinning goes out as a generally available feature that then a configuration could at least fail intentionally because a developer or user could have signaled to us through a pin that they do not want this version to increase. So that was really the inflection point in my mind where I could say Winget is stable enough and there's enough capability there that I can now look at building desired state on top of that. And where Winget would not do something like Chocolaty with pre-deploy and post-deploy scripts, you may be able to get that with desired state configuration, but you really have to understand idempotence before you just start trying to go write some script resources to brute force it through. You could end up quite unhappy in a situation like that.
Do you like that approach? It sounds like that.
I do like the declarative approach. I had some early discussions with the PowerShell team when I was doing some research on what was out there. I really didn't want to go invent another technology or another tool. I like that Microsoft already had PowerShell DSC. There's a vibrant community building DSC resources. There's a lot of people that understand that technology. So I thought this one was an opportunity to reinvest in something that we have and hopefully bring more people to the community and make it not just in the domain of those IT experts that understand desired state from deploying and configuring environments or managing large fleets of servers, but really bring it to developers who have this need when they're doing software projects.
We're getting full circle when we think about that desired state configuration is primarily seen as a server technology, at least if you see at the example that first showed up, how to create something in Active Directory, stuff like that. And we learned that the app installer is focused on the user. And then we have Intune, Azure Guest Policy, and I have to take care that I don't mention the wrong words here because things constantly change. And sometimes it's an abstract. Sometimes underlying is the classic DSC. Sometimes it's something completely different. Is it just me getting confused by that?
We went through a lot of challenges with dependencies and the binary modules between Windows PowerShell and PowerShell 7. We had some other challenges with how we were calling the .NET runtime when we were doing that. We're looking right now at a point where today we're using DSC v2, but we're calling invoke DSC resource to apply that desired state. And we're actively working with the PowerShell team on what they envision for DSC v3. And we're doing this together so that we can collaborate more, make sure we're getting the right feedback and addressing what users want. My hope is that we'll be able to start building up a new collection of contributors to come in and build more of the resources for things that developers need that aren't quite the same as what you necessarily would want for Windows Server. But I think that using this kind of a methodology, we'll end up with more people on the same technology. And I think in some cases, the technology is not as important as the community that's using it and growing it and teaching each other and learning.
Microsoft recently, in the recent years, reached out to a lot of people that they couldn't get on in previous years. I'd like to mention WSL, the subsystem for Linux. Very popular, a little bit strange somehow, how beloved. Do I open the box of Pandora if I ask, what is the next step? Have you ever talked to the guys of WSL to get some glue in between
these technologies?
I've had some
fantastic conversations with Craig.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So we discussed what it would look like, and I think the original project idea, I think Clint from the Power Toys team was the first one to really throw the idea out, but he said, it would be fantastic if I could have a configuration that I could run on Windows, would configure my Windows environment, would configure WSL, would get the Docker desktop running on WSL where it runs most efficiently, be able to access hardware GPU acceleration, and be able to just jump straight into TensorFlow.
What could possibly go wrong?
he spent a couple of days trying to do this manually and had to call some experts in for help. I've had some great discussions with Craig on his thoughts around DSC and is this a single configuration that does everything, including the Linux work? Or does the DSC make sure that WSL with Ubuntu and all of the prerequisites are in place and then put some files in there and then call another configuration? One of the things that you get with desired state is a tremendous amount of power and capability. And we want to reason through the thought process around, would I want some Linux-specific DSC resources? Would I group them differently within modules? You know, even the same application on Windows might be configured completely differently in Linux. And that's where those DSE resources come in with that domain-specific and platform-specific knowledge. But I would love to be in a situation where if you're in an enterprise, configurations can be pushed to your machine, or you can access the one you're authorized to and you can run them. For developers, they can do that. I could imagine a lovely backup restore scenario where I could leverage something similar to the behavior of reverse DSE, which has had some interesting work done on it. But even with that, if I look at SQL Server or IIS, there could be thousands of properties. It would be even more exciting if I could just say, give me the ones that aren't default, so that I could generate a configuration file that you could then modify or just hand over to another system and say, run this configuration.
I fear I already know the answer of the next question, but nevertheless, I try my luck. Any plans that someone in the Microsoft ecosystem embraces your technology and you reach out to something like Winget update my drivers, Winget update my Windows updates?
I've had a lot of those thoughts and discussions. Drivers are tricky because you really don't want to just take some random executable driver off the web. There's a lot of concerns around drivers being signed. There's been asks around Winget looking at trusting signatures rather than hashes. Lots of different opinions there. Technically, Winget could call Windows update if we built the code to do that. I don't know that Winget is really mature enough to make a decision about, do we integrate with that? You know, I know people would love to be able to say Winget upgrade Windows and magic happens and it's just done. You know, the good news is we have had a lot of other teams integrating with us. If you saw Build this year, the Microsoft DevBox announcement, they're looking at Winget configuration. We're talking to some other internal teams at Microsoft that have these kinds of challenges. We've been talking with Intune, been doing some exciting work with the Xbox team and working with them on doing things like publishing the gamer development kit. If you're following the DevHome now provides a UI experience on top of a lot of lovely features that we've built for developers. And I think in the future, you're going to see more of that. And we're trying to do more of this work in the open and provide practical samples and examples to help you get started.
I'd like to wrap that up with, if these numbers are public and if you want to talk about that, you mentioned very, very often the community. And there are lots of people who engage, some very heavy, some very lightweight. But how many people do work, such as you, in your team to give a number and that people can assume how much work is it? How many employees do you have in your team?
I think it ranges. You could probably say 10 to 12 software engineers. Could be dedicated to the project at any point in time. It could go up a little bit or down a little bit, depending on the other work that's happening. So it's given the impact of a package manager, it's not that large of a team, but many engineering teams at Microsoft are smaller than that. But we have a lot more work going on than just the client. We have all of the back-end validation work, the manifest, the rest.
And the second that you embrace the community, someone's got to read all the bugs, all the commands, all the things that are discussed on GitHub, and that eats up a lot of time, right? So if you do something in the dark, that saves you a lot of time also. What did I not ask? What is the one thing that you think might be important, maybe a topic that is somewhere in the distance? Is there something, or did we get it all?
I think we've covered most of the roadmap, sort of the current state of Winget. I think the bigger thing for me is really the discoverability challenge. Mm-hmm. Why isn't everybody using this? Why aren't all of the publishers publishing? And I think it's really an adoption curve. You know, we talked a lot about how the syntax looks a lot like Linux. People coming from Linux to Windows or people that are using both of them, command line package managers have been around for decades. And so it's very natural and comfortable for them. I think in the Windows ecosystem, you know, unless you've been around long enough to be predating Windows, or if you have actively been developing on Mac and using Homebrew, or developing on Linux, where you've got lots of different package managers, it's a new concept. So I think there's a lot that could be done to spread the word and, you know, let more people know about it, and not just WinGet, any of the package managers. You know, at the end of the day, it's really just trying to make it easier to install and manage your software. And I think the more people that are doing this and using these tools, we're going to have a more rich catalog. We're going to have better behaved software. And since we're open source, if there's a bug or a feature that somebody wants to work on, we've had plenty of contributions of some really fantastic features from the community. You know, one of the funny ones, my boss was going through and doing some work, and he was having a hard time, couldn't remember where the logs were. And so he created an issue and said, I'd like to just have a command that'll open that folder for me. Mm-hmm. And one of our community members went in and built all of that out. So you can say WinGet install or upgrade, whatever your command is. You can append at the end of that dash dash verbose dash logs, or you can put that in your settings. Mm-hmm. And then you can do dash dash open logs or dash dash logs. And as soon as that command is completed, the directory opens up with the logs. That was one of those things.
That's a good idea, yeah.
That was one of those things that probably wouldn't have been prioritized by me. I've got, you know, more sort of impactful features. But one of the community members thought that that would be useful, and it's been absolutely useful.
I'm very thankful that you're so open-minded, and you really do a fantastic job to spread the word and to explain something that are not so mature yet, but you will improve that. The community will improve that. I really do thank you for your time. My final question is, there is always some Easter egg. There is always some niche little nerdy things. Most of you will know the little rainbow that you can enable, but I'm aware there is another Easter egg. Would you like to tell that as my last question to answer that?
Sure. So if you've seen my Twitter profile, and it's DENELONMS, if you look at the background picture, there's an ASCII image of the cat waving the flag riding the dinosaur. And that was from the first experimental command and the first experimental argument. We built that toggle in so that we could do experimentation, let users try things and give us feedback. And then whenever we've got sufficient quality, then we can go to going ahead and making that feature stable. So that was just one of those fun things that one of the engineers decided was the way to prove out that scenario in the product. And we talked a couple of times about maybe removing it, but I think we'll just leave it. I like it.
So now you have something that you can test on yourself. Dimitrios, it was my pleasure. Thank you that you took your time.
Well, my pleasure as well. Thank you.